This is Anya Leonard, the co-founder of Classical Wisdom, a website dedicated to bringing ancient wisdom to modern minds. Today we have a very special guest, Dr. Anthony Arthur Long. He is the Chancellor's Professor Emeritus of Classics and Irving Stone Professor of Literature Emeritus, as well as the Affiliated Professor of Philosophy and Rhetoric at the University of California, Berkeley. Professor Long is often credited with spearheading the revived interest in Stoicism as well as other ancient philosophies, and has written several books on the topic, including How to Be Free, An Ancient Guide to the Stoic Life. He has kindly agreed to speak to us today on the topic of his recent essay, Natural Catastrophe in Greek and Roman Philosophy, and what ancient philosophies can teach us in the here and now. I just wanted to say it's interesting that Stoicism has become so popular, and Marcus Aurelius is, you know, as you just said, a pop figure almost nowadays.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, he's perhaps the most accessible of the ancient Stoics for modern readers. He's a very good writer. There's a bit of a question, you know, about really, was he really a Stoic? He wasn't a Stoic, I think, in the sense that Epictetus was. He was a Stoic. He was a teacher, and Marcus Aurelius was an emperor, and so he's using ancient philosophy, especially Stoicism, as his own way of trying to understand the situations he's finding himself in. And some of them are very horrible situations. I mean, something I've only realized recently, as you perhaps know, is that he had to deal with a terrible pandemic in Rome. In the end, that pandemic seemed probably killed him. I mean, he probably caught it was probably a virus much worse than the one we're dealing with at the moment. But he seems to have been very, very concerned about people and making, you know, his own imperial property available to people and going out and meeting people. So yeah, he was a great ancient hero.
Yeah, it's these pandemics. I mean, they really do change our mindset and make us sort of aware of, you know, that we live together in a society and it's not just us. I mean, these are really amazing times. You've actually been working on a book called Natural Catastrophe in Greek and Roman Philosophy. So going back to the ancient world, how did the ancients respond to natural catastrophes? How did they deal with their own pandemics?
Good. I mean, when I started this work, I wasn't thinking so much of plagues and viruses, but more things like earthquakes and tsunamis. What the work I've done so far doesn't particularly address viruses and plagues. But, you know, I think a lot of the conditions are similar in the sense that we're suddenly being faced with something we can't control. So your question really, you know, just to answer it as briefly as possible, I think one wants to distinguish between the earliest ancient responses to disasters. You can go right back to the Iliad. I mean, the Iliad's our earliest Greek literature, and it actually starts with a plague. Now, the plague there has been caused by the fact that one of the great characters of the Iliad, Agamemnon, has misbehaved according to one of the gods, and so the god is punishing everybody else with a plague. But it's interesting that this great epic begins with a plague. Perhaps Greek tragedies, greatest Greek tragedy, Sophocles' Oedipus, King Oedipus, begins with a plague.
Yeah, I was just thinking that one.
So these are examples, and you could take not just plague, you could take earthquakes. These are the ancient people, not just ancient Greeks, but people, I think, always. You know, if you were a polytheistic society, you attributed such disasters outside human control to divine powers. Divine powers are very powerful, and we have to keep our heads down. And so I think one way of trying to cope in the ancient world before philosophy and science sort of became more important were, you know, telling stories, telling great mythological stories about, you know, gods and heroes. So you could have a heroic survival like Ulysses. But of course, Ulysses, the Odyssey, is also full of misbehavior. I mean, Odysseus says men are very greedy, and so they come to grief through their own misbehavior. So you know, you already have there some distinctions between natural disasters, a god's anger, but human disasters which are brought about by our own failings, as the stories tell us. So that's so mythology is a very important, I think, way of trying to cope there. And I think when we're thinking about modern ways of coping, we might want to think about the kind of stories we tell. I mean, our media, we love sex and violence on TV, but we don't have so many stories, I think, about perhaps, how did we come to be the species we are? So the kind of things that, I think Freud put it so very well in, even before the Second World War, in civilization and its discontents. There are two sides to the human beings. One of great, achievement and what we used to call a conquest of nature. And now it's all suddenly coming back upon us. And, I've tended to wonder whether pandemics and ecology don't come together in some way. I mean, part of my own background with the book is I'm a passionate green person. So I think that, when we talk in the present context of the pandemic about going back to normal, I say, I really hope not, I mean, normal was not so good. Normal was going very bad, in fact. So we need to change our behavior that way.
Yeah, we were sort of already kind of going in a very unsustainable direction. And you wonder about these disturbances, maybe they're very helpful in a way that to make us reevaluate and readdress our situations.
I do think that, exactly. So, one of your first questions when we were corresponding about this was, how did the ancients cope? I think the big intellectual shift which came with the beginnings of what we call Greek philosophy and science, and of course, when I'm saying this is it, we're talking about a very small number of people who are being influenced by these things or doing the influencing themselves. But I mean, it is a colossal, I think, shift to suddenly start thinking, well, maybe something like an earthquake isn't caused by a god's anger. Perhaps there are actual things that we can call, forces like fire and wind, which are actually causing these things. It's not personal at all. And if we only studied things in a certain way, we could actually perhaps begin to understand them. And so the notion of understanding as a way of coping, if we can find causes of things, then things become less scary. It doesn't mean they go away. And ancient science, of course, was not technologically based. It wasn't intended to control nature. But in a certain way, I do think if you have an understanding of why something happened, you are, in a sense, helping to control it, whether it's a plague or something else. I mean, just staying away from pandemics for the moment. I mean, just to give a very interesting example, there was a terrible catastrophe that occurred, which is probably the origin of the Atlantis story in a Greek colony called Helike on the Gulf of Corinth. It was a colony, it was a city-state, completely wiped out in one day by a most appalling earthquake and tsunami. And the people of Helike were their patron god was Poseidon. So of course Poseidon must have been terribly angry because he's destroying the city of it, well, which he's the patron god. And so that goes down, I think, probably in antiquity as the greatest natural disaster. It's told by everybody right up into the Christian period, and right up into that period, people are saying we must have got Poseidon really mad with us. But at the same time, people are explaining it in entirely naturalistic terms. So you've got competing explanations of things, and I mean that's always going to be so, I think. But the idea that we might somehow, through human exploration and understanding, be able to find a way of dealing with things, at least emotionally, in terms of understanding, is I think that perhaps the greatest contribution ancient philosophy can have for us today.
It's interesting. You're mentioning earthquakes, and I've lived in a few different places where we've had a lot of earthquakes. I lived in Taipei for a while and also in Mexico City. And, you know, it's really interesting because in both places I experienced a lot of earthquakes. But they're very different cultures and very different responses, but also different technology. And, you know, in Taiwan, you had Taipei 101, which is this enormous building that's sitting right on top of, you know, a constant earthquake zone, as this sort of this huge, bold human defiance against nature. And the technology that is employed there is, you know, phenomenal. I mean, it's really amazing. But, you know, in Mexico City, I was there during the very deadly September 19th earthquake, and hundreds of people died. And, you know, there, the fear of it was much more palpable because you didn't have the technology.
I mean, you know, I live in an earthquake zone too. I lived through the big one in the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, when I was actually very lucky to avoid being on what we call the Bay Bridge, which then collapsed. But I was, you know, about 10 minutes away from it. But we live through these all the time. I think what's, you know, something we need to be thinking about at the moment, I mean, if you take something like Hurricane Katrina, which, you know, really devastated New Orleans and Louisiana State, and it was a terrible disaster and wasn't coped with very well. I mean, this was a time when George Bush was president. I didn't get, you know, when he was saying good job done and it wasn't finished. But in any case, I mean, it should have been obvious that this is not a piece of geography and geology where you want to be building what you are doing. I mean, hurricanes are going to happen all the time, and yet people continue to live, say, on the Florida on the coast. You know, it comes hurricane season, and everybody gets, oh, you know, oh, terrible thing is going to happen, but it's bound to happen. I mean, it's the inevitability of hurricanes and human sort of naivety seems, you know, something. School kids could understand this, and yet we seem to, and then you just get mad with officialdom for not coping. But how does it, if you're going to live there?
Yeah, you think of the island of Galveston. I mean, it was completely wiped out in the year 1900, and instead of, you know, demolishing everything, they just built the island on top of the ruins from the destruction, and then it gets devastated again. You know, it's you're totally right. But do you think then that this, because we have technology, that we think that we can handle these natural disasters, that we can live in these places, and that we won't learn from?
Well, look, I mean, we obviously are, you know, in terms of healthcare and technology, we are obviously at a huge advantage over ancient people in extraordinary ways. I mean, who would want to, you know, ancient Rome might seem a glorious city when you read about it, but it was a stinking and, you know, flea-ridden and virus-infected city, and so we don't want to be back there. But I do, yes, I do think though that our modern, you know, expertise in these ways and achievements, the negative side is that we have higher expectations than are realistic. I think what's going back to the ecology thing, I think above all, you know, what we are realizing and should be realizing is that we are using up resources at a terrible rate. So I think that longer term, I'm more worried about the climate change than I am about the pandemic. The pandemic is devastating and awful, but it will stop. But the other thing won't stop unless we do something about it.
Yeah. And that could have even larger consequences, you know.
Right, exactly. So,
To go back to the ancients then, we have this modern technology and all this. What can ancient philosophy do to help us during this? I mean, what sort of specifics of ancient knowledge would be useful to us now?
Well, thinking more about the philosophers, and it doesn't have to be simply the Stoic philosophers. I think other philosophies that developed at the same time as Stoicism, I mean, the Epicurean philosophy, the Cynics, I think what all of these philosophies had in common was not that they developed in order to help people to cope with a particular disaster. There was a theory when I started my work that Athens' great days were over and somehow autocracies were coming in and getting rid of democracy, and that people couldn't cope, so they needed new philosophies. Well, I think there's very little truth, I think, in that. These philosophies developed at times that were pretty good times for the people living there. So I think they weren't designed, I think, as strategies for coping. They were designed, I think, for, well, intellectual enjoyment on its own, but also to enrich experience, for people to realize that there was a lot more to life than, sort of wine, women, and song, that we have human resources that we can draw on which will be very helpful in bad times, but are also available for good times. I think that's very important. I think something perhaps modern Stoics have lost, and it's perhaps built into the modern notion of Stoicism as a philosophy of sort of resignation, of repression of emotion. And that's really just not there in the ancient sources. Stoicism and these other philosophies are designed for all times, good times as well as bad times. So you're asking about, well, what strategies can they give us? And I think that, well, in both the Greek, before the philosophers really got underway, the Greeks had a notion that's very hard to translate. Greek word for it is sophrosyne. It literally means safe thinking. It's sophro means sort of moderate and so it's kind of a way of, often translated as moderation or self-control, but those are rather slightly misleading. It's really a sort of way of trying to put yourself in relation to the world in a way that you can, the world won't master you and you won't sort of over try to master the world. It's a kind of balance. It's balance. It's what we call it, balance. So I think if it sounds kind of perhaps not very sexy, but the notion of a balanced life. But that this is, I think, an ideal which is very much there. And when the Stoics defined their good life, they just said it's living in accordance with experience of natural events. And this brings me to one of your other very good questions, I think, where you asked me whether one could really be a Stoic if you didn't have had to face some, difficult situation. And I think the Stoic answer would probably be, it would be hard. It's hard to be a Stoic. In fact, nobody, I think you put it in one of your questions to me, you said, can one achieve a full understanding of Stoicism without enduring a great difficulty? Does that make catastrophe in a way necessary? And I'd like to try to respond by saying, I don't think the Stoics thought that anybody can ever achieve a full understanding of Stoicism. Stoicism is always going to be an unfinished project. The most you can hope to do is to make some kind of progress through, I mean, not technological progress, not material progress, but emotional, mental progress. The most you can try to achieve is some kind of progress through really trying to understand the world that you're living in. That's the notion of experience. The German philosopher Schopenhauer quoted the Stoics here by saying that what Stoicism is trying to achieve and what Chrysippus meant by this is not trying to go beyond not what's possible, that human beings exceed their situation. Now, I mean, this is why I think that Stoicism is difficult, because we must, as a species, I think, be hardwired to be, to be optimistic. I mean, obviously human beings have had to struggle to survive as a species. And so we're always having to, make adjustments and so forth. And I think Stoicism allows for that, but it's also trying to tell us always how to be prepared for whatever's going to, you can't predict exactly what's going to happen. And so it's a matter of trying to make people ready for anything, I think. That it's this kind of readiness of being able to adjust oneself, not giving up on all the ordinary things that one likes about family and success and comfort, but just realizing that these things are never just things you can take for granted.
Yeah, I like that. Many of the Stoics would suggest sleeping on the floor from time to time, or to endure hardship so that you know that you can handle it as well, and that you will survive it, and that takes away a bit of the fear of it. And it makes me think, like, again, in Mexico, for instance, most people had a bag at the front of their door with their most valuable possessions because they were used to running, sprinting out of the house when the alarm started and having 60 seconds to make it out. And that kind of regular reminder puts your life in perspective. If you're facing that fear of death on a somewhat regular basis, I mean, it changes your mindset, definitely.
Yeah. So another question, of course, you asked me, which I think this is relevant to, is you asked me about, I'm just trying to find the way you put it, was why do you think there's been a revival of Stoicism lately? And I mean, there certainly has been an enormous interest in a kind of, well, you know, not to be kind of snooty, but I mean, what one might call pop Stoicism, you know, Stoicism, you know, there's this wonderful little book here called Stoicism Today. It's, you know, Stoicism for working mums, Stoicism for the woman in the checkout counter, Stoicism for doctors. Okay, that's great. But I think all of this kind of Stoicism, which fits into a sort of, you know, a certain, you know, interest today, you know, everybody has to have their therapist, and Stoicism as a kind of self-help thing. And it, I mean, I think it's great. I mean, when I started my work, nobody talked that way. Stoicism was a minor academic pursuit, and it then something sort of turned around. And I don't think we quite know why. It must have something to do with the zeitgeist, you know, in some things, you know, there are all kinds of explanations of why things happen, which, you know, may not be the way they, you know, certainly somebody read a book and somebody else talked to somebody else. And so it happened. Anyway, take it. But I think if there's something missing in this sort of modern Stoicism, I think it's the social dimension of Stoicism. Even if you take the ancient Stoics, I mean, one of them is, let's say Marcus Aurelius was a Stoic. Well, he's doing a big social job. He's an emperor. Epictetus is a teacher. And Seneca, who'd been, involved in Neronian politics in a very big way and then got fired. when he writes his letter, I mean, he puts his Stoicism into letters to a friend. So there's always a social dimension to Stoicism. It's not something although Marcus Aurelius, he wrote what this work he called to himself, I think that may have given him a somewhat misconception of Stoicism as a sort of something to do on your own and just a kind of meditative practice. You can use it that way, of course. But I think, you know, Stoicism is really a social philosophy. It's intended, I mean, Stoics thought that we all have these instincts to live together in a contented way. So I think that what's perhaps missing in a lot of the modern way of Stoicism is the idea of how we can use Stoicism in a kind of community way, in a communal way. And I mean, you know, there are all the cliches about today about how we're not, you know, and politicians are not focused on the common good and all that. Well, you know, what I think is lying behind that is something about modern materialist culture, where, you know, I'm not talking about people going wrong, but politicians seeing their role as simply trying to, you know, satisfy economic satisfactions rather than getting into the question of, well, what really helps people to feel, you know, fulfilled and contented, because when we then get into issues to do with education. as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because you think of Epicureanism and that definitely had a social element. I mean, historically, you think of the communes and such like that. And that one, I think people can see the social element in that philosophy a lot more. Whereas, yeah, you're right. Modern Stoicism is sort of like a self-help. Here's your writing journal, make your notes every day.
Absolutely, yes. You know, nothing wrong with that, of course. I mean, and you know, any good, philosophy which has a kind of psychological foundation as Stoicism does have, you know, it's good to have to adapt to different situations. So I don't want to criticize that. I'm simply saying that there's a dimension I think that perhaps some people may be missing, which Stoicism can help you to to help if you are thinking in terms of social norms.
Well, I think we should definitely throw a large Stoics party, maybe when all of this is over, a Stoics ball or something. We can really bring the social element back into it. I would love to do that. Now, you've been taking such wonderful time out of your day to speak to us. So I just wanted to maybe respond a bit more about any other tactics from the ancient world that would be very valuable for people to sort of understand and know. Like, I mean, because 2020 is a year of disruption and upheaval, and that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing, as you mentioned before. I mean, I don't want to sound like the constant optimist and looking for the silver lining, but I think sometimes when we have these moments of disruption, we can unearth, you know, previous systems or bureaucracies or bad cultural movements that need to be refreshed, that need to be moved, and you know, like ecological awareness and things like that. So what are some of the other things that we can kind of take from ancient history that can be really valuable in this moment of shiftingness?
Oh, yes. No, well, I was thinking when I ended the book I wrote a few years ago on the one called Greek Models of Mind. And I ended it, the last chapter on that was really trying to sort of talk about different ways in which the ancient philosophers presented ideals of happiness. And I ended with talking about Stoicism there. And I think I'd just like to use that as a way into to answer your question. I said that what Stoicism, I think, has to offer us most of all today is a sense of human dignity or self-worth. And what I meant by that was I think that what we are perhaps missing in the way our cultures have, you know, presented things to us is that human beings, I think, are, again, hardwired, again, probably for survival reasons, with enormous internal resources. I mean, I don't mean you have to be a whiz mathematician. I mean simply that we are, I think, given a kind of mental powers in which we are able to, you know, through imagination and understanding, enlarge our experience and much more capacity for coping than is presented. So I think, you know, what we're dealing with the present moment, whether it's been through questions of gender or questions of race or questions of sexual orientation, all of these are incredibly positive aspects of our current culture. You know, of course, they involve a lot of tensions in society, but that's fine. But they are focused on externals. They're definitely focused on, and quite rightly, because what modern history and culture has achieved in the West and other developed countries is a way of trying to help people in a material way which was just absent under old autocracies and aristocracies. So that's all there. But then I think keeping all of that, trying to keep that, but then recognizing that we still have this other, these internal capacities, which are not up to governments to provide us with, or electoral manifestos, But and the only way to harness that, I think, is through education, and discussion. And so I would, you know, this is when I was writing my little responses for Ryan Holiday, his stoic blog, and I said, you know, there what I'd want to do would be to treble or, you know, quadruple teachers' salaries, but also have a very, you know, without junking all the modern needs, you know, for, you know, computer literacy and other skills, but I don't think teaching should just be a question of skills. It should be a question of developing what I keep calling understanding, meaning a kind of breadth of sympathy. It involves emotion as well as intellect. I think that our educational system doesn't really capture that, does it?
I completely agree. And you know, it's so interesting that before all of this, you know, I was very fascinated about the ideas of education and you know, what the future of it should be. And I'm a mother, I have a young daughter, and you know, with everything that's happened and the schools being shut, it's really a moment right now where people are questioning what education is. And I personally would love to have elements of education that involved like ethics or logic, you know, some of those ancient concepts, but those are what really makes a well-rounded person. And you know, I love history, but for some people, memorizing certain dates is not really that valuable. It's better to understand, you know, trends and understanding human nature and questioning it and being able to communicate well with each other and debate. And I mean, these are very valuable lifelong skills.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is absolutely right. And I mean, the greatest text I think that ever has been written so far is Plato's Republic. I mean, of course, it seems to have an elitist side to it. It's because it's, you know, talking about it's anti-democracy in many ways, but at the same time, it has this incredible richness of the emotional and the intellectual. I mean, the way in which Plato envisions that the ideal rulers of a community, it'll take them 30 years of education and challenge before they are equipped to actually enter into politics. They have to have such a broad experience of the world, and again, you know, they're not an aristocracy of birth. They have to earn their place in society, but you know, by being tested. So, if you will, it's a meritocracy, but it's a meritocracy not of privilege, but of, and remember, I mean, because the most amazing thing is that they're not allowed to have private property. Yeah, so of course it's a utopian project, yeah. But it's still so marvelously challenging to read.